Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
JBR Capital has sponsored the Intercooler podcast for several months now. You've probably heard me talk about the company before. In that time, I've come to really understand what it is that makes JBR Capital different to other car finance companies. If I had to boil it down to one thing, I'd say it's this. Car finance is all JBR Capital does. Might sound like a minor detail, that, but in fact, it's really important. It means JBR Capital has a profound understanding of the car marketplace and of car buyers, an understanding that other finance companies could only hope to have. In fact, that very focused approach is exactly why the company was started in the first place. We recently had Darren Selig, founder of JBR Capital, on the podcast, episode 106, if you want to go back and listen. And he explained that he started the company when he realized that general finance lenders actually didn't understand cars or car buyers particularly well at all. So he spotted that gap in the market and he founded JBR Capital to fill it. So before you buy your next car, be it a supercar, sports car, classic car, a hypercar, or a luxury car, even if it's a brand new car, go and see what JBR Capital can do for you on the finance side. And it really helps us if you tell them that the Intercooler sent you. JBR Capital is authorized and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority.
Welcome to the Intercooler podcast.
Welcome to episode 112 of the podcast, everybody. Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel with you here. Andrew, so it's Friday morning, the Friday morning of the Monaco Grand Prix weekend.
As we're recording this, yeah.
As we're recording this. And this episode is all about the Monaco Grand Prix. But of course, because of our schedules, we're having to record this before the weekend's race. And so we've agreed, haven't we, that if it's a really exciting race, we're going to get back on our Zoom call on Monday morning and do a couple more minutes about the race itself. So if it's a good race, we will now talk about it for a few minutes. Well, actually, Dan, we're not going to talk about it for a few minutes. In fact, I'm not going to bother getting Andrew back on the line to talk about the Grand Prix at all. So you'll just have to put up with me blathering on for 30 seconds or so. Because it was a sort of compelling Grand Prix, wasn't it? Lots happened. It was fairly dramatic with the weather, the changeable weather, torrential rain at the start, drying out throughout the Grand Prix. Strategy calls won the race. There was at least one big smash for Mick Schumacher. Thankfully, he was unhurt. But once again, it just wasn't a particularly exciting motor race, not anything like exciting enough for me to bother getting Andrew back on the line to talk about it. So congratulations to Sergio Perez, a popular winner. And he deserved it. I mean, the Red Bull pit wall was perhaps as responsible for that victory as he was. He drove beautifully, but strategy was a big, big part of it. And he deserved it because he was quicker than Verstappen all weekend. Is he now in this title fight? I hope so. I guess we'll find out soon. Right, let's get back to the podcast. If it's another processional race, we won't bother at all. But should we? I mean, I want this episode to sort of look at the history of the Monaco Grand Prix, but also I want it to be a discussion about the Monaco Grand Prix as it is nowadays. Do you just want to briefly explain why it's worth having that discussion?
Well, I mean, I think that there are two factors here, aren't there? There's the whole sort of social side of it, and whether it still deserves its sort of special status in the calendar, whether, frankly, it still should be regarded alongside the 24 Hours at Le Mans and the Indianapolis 500 as the one of the three sort of blue ribbon events of motor racing. When, you know, you've got so many other circuits coming along, and this leads into the second problem, when they're frankly, the circuit is so completely fairly unsuited to racing when it started in 1929. It is so totally unsuited to, and all of us, don't we, as I say, we're recording this on the Friday, but we're all, you know, and I may be eating my words come Monday morning, but we're all sitting here and, you know, we know that so often the race is decided on Saturday, and that unless something strange happens, and it does, because it rains sometimes, and then you can get completely freak results. I give you Olivier Panis. And all sorts of strange things can happen. But, you know, if everything goes the way it usually goes, which is that it's dry and, you know, whoever's on pole, you know, leads into Saint-Devot, then that's kind of it, isn't it? You know, and, you know, some genuine overtaking at Monaco has always been hard. But these days, I'd looked it up. So the first race in 1929 was won by a Brit called Grover Williams in a Type 35 Bugatti. Modern Formula One car is over 50% wider. It's over half as wide again as a Type 35. But they're running around the same streets, which are the same width. I mean, it's bonkers. I mean, they were pretty narrow whenever it was, 93 years ago. And now, you know, I can't imagine racing a Formula One car, frankly, but I mean, I couldn't imagine racing a car. I mean, I've been very lucky. I raced a C-Type Jag there, 8 years ago. And that was absolutely as big and wide a car as I'd ever want to race around those streets. So what it's like having another sort of, you know, half a meter of motor car out either side of you, I don't know. But, so it's just become this sort of strange event. It's almost, well, it is a motor race in that you have winners and losers, but it's not a motor race in that it's, you know, something where you can routinely expect people to be trying to overtake each other. And it becomes this, it almost becomes a parade, doesn't it? It becomes a sort of procession, and it's wonderful because the place is beautiful and it's glamorous and there's the harbour and it's all, you know, glitzy and everything else. But yeah, there are a dozen or more other places on the calendar where, you know, I'd rather go and see a motor race.
Yeah, I suppose at the heart of it, it's this sort of the gap between the Monaco Grand Prix's reputation and status as one of three of the Triple Crown of motorsport. So it has this amazing status, and yet the racing is so often tedious and processional, and so it very rarely lives up to its reputation or its promise. And so that's why it's worth having this conversation about the Monaco Grand Prix. But before we sort of get into that debate, should we just look right back at the origins of it? Because actually, its inception was created for very boring, pragmatic, unglamorous reasons. As you said, the first race was in 1929, organised by Anthony Noge with the blessing of Prince Louis II through the Automobile Club de Monaco. And the ACM organised Rally Monte Carlo. That the rally predates the Grand Prix. And the ACM wanted to become recognised as an international governing body rather than just a regional French governing body. And the issue was that there was no, despite the Monte Carlo rally, there was no motorsport event solely within the Principality of Monaco. The rally was all across Europe, wasn't it?
And it converged on Monaco. So the point being is that no internationally recognised sporting event started in Monaco. They all started somewhere else. So they might have ended there, but yeah, absolutely right.
So the ACM needed an event that was within the confines of the Principality entirely. And hence this idea to race Grand Prix cars around the streets of Monaco. So yeah, it first happened in 1929. I think we've probably had the discussion about William Grover Williams before, haven't we? Who won that first race in a Bugatti Type 35B. I'm sure you have written about William Grover Williams for the Intercooler app. So if people want to know his story, and it's an amazing one, you should be able to find it on the app. So that's the sort of origins of it.
Ooh, have I though? It's awful, isn't it? I should be able to remember this. I hope you can find it on that. If not, find a way of letting us know, and I will.
He was absolutely...
Well, actually, there were three of them. There were him, there was Robert Benoit, and there was Jean-Pierre Vimille, all of whom worked for SOE, the Special Operations Executive, during the war. Whatever they achieved in motor racing, frankly, is completely immaterial compared to what they achieved with the French Resistance in the war. And two of the three of them, sadly, didn't survive to see the other side of it. The third, frankly, didn't survive that long once he was out the other side of it. But, if I haven't, I will.
Yeah, because it's definitely a story worth telling and worth reading. Okay, so, and as we know, through the 50s and 60s, it became a very prestigious event, didn't it, the Monaco Grand Prix?
Yeah.
And it's during this era that your old mate, the late Stirling Moss, won it three times, and he didn't call it the Monaco Grand Prix, did he?
Sterling, for reasons best known to Sterling, and it may be, I mean, he would have got it from somewhere, so it may be what everybody called it today. He used to call it Monaco.
Monaco.
And I always used to titter. I don't know why Monaco is funny, but it just is. But it's interesting, isn't it? You know, so he won it three times, 56, 60 and 61. And you'd think, insofar as it's not fast, it's not got those sorts of corners where you know, if you're in your Maserati 250F or whatever, you'd be in these enormous, endless drifts. You wouldn't have thought it was a particularly Stirling-type place, but he loved it. He clearly loved the nightlife and all the stuff that went with it. But he actually, he found it suited him terribly well. Because, I don't know, there was a sort of precision. And the other thing about Stirling is, however fast he drove, however extravagantly he drove, he never used more than an inch of tarmac than he ever wanted to. He was like sort of Jim Clark in that regard. And if you're a lesser talent at somewhere like Monaco, you know, and you can't drive that precisely, then you either slow down or you don't, and you're in the wall. And the way he could thread it, it enabled him, memorably in 1961, to hold off a pack of ridiculously faster Ferraris for the duration of the race. And he absolutely loved that. It actually, in a totally different way to somewhere like, you know, the old Spa or the Nürburgring, it showed it was a great level. You know, the greater your talent, the better you would do there. It wasn't like sort of places like Reims and Monza, which are great slipstreaming places where, frankly, the bloke with the most powerful engine was likely to win the race. It was as much as the Nürburgring, as much as the old Spa, it's a proper driver's circuit. He absolutely adored the place.
Mm. Yeah, won it three times. Over the years, two cars have ended up in the harbour. Actually, that's a surprisingly small number, because whenever I see the cars racing around there and their proximity to the drink, I just think, crikey, at any moment someone could end up in there. But it's only happened twice. Alberto Ascari and Paul Hawkins, neither were seriously hurt. They were able to get out and swim to safety. I suppose neither of them would have had belts or harnesses.
No, absolutely not. No, because and if they had, they'd probably have been killed.
Oh my goodness me! Well, it doesn't bear because thinking now, does it? The halo, the hands device, the 6-point harness. I'm not sure you stand a chance, would you?
You'd never get out. No, let's not think about that.
That's awful. I mean, only two cars have ended up in the water, and
it's probably just about the only example, isn't it, of having no safety ends up saving your life.
Yeah. It's an extraordinary thought, actually.
Although, obviously back then, and I'm digressing a little bit, but, you know, it's a point worth making that, you know, it's not as if they didn't know about, you know, safety belts and that sort of thing in the 50s. The reason they weren't fitted is they were all so frightened of cars catching fire, they far fancy, they far more fancy their chances out of the car than in it. And so if you're going to have a big one, you actually want it to be chucked out of the car. Awful way that sounds.
Ah, different times. You earn yourself 1,000 intercooler points, which are not redeemable anywhere, if you can name the third car and driver that's ended up in the Monaco harbour.
The third car and driver? Well, I thought there only were two, so clearly, but it wasn't in a Formula One race.
Nope.
I'm guessing.
It was in a depiction of a Formula One race.
In a depiction of a Formula One race? Oh, hang on. Oh, yeah. Okay. So we're talking about Grand Prix, the Frankenheimer movie. Brian Bedford.
Oh, well done.
I'm going to give you... He was meant to be in a Lotus, wasn't he?
Well done.
But, well, I can't remember what they called. What do they call it? It was Brian Bedford playing Scott Stoddart, wasn't it?
Okay, yes. Yeah, you're right.
In the Frankenheimer movie Grand Prix, and yes, it was meant to be in a Lotus, but they didn't call it a Lotus. I can't remember what they called it, but yeah, he ended up in the drink.
That'll come to you in the next 10 minutes or something.
Probably.
But yeah, there you go. Yeah, if you haven't seen it, it's... actually, the more shocking part is the crash that somebody has. And it's clearly just a doll that's being thrown around, but, you know, some sort of mannequin. But it's weirdly graphic and... disturbing when you see that accident. Okay, let's just talk about some of the more amazing, memorable occasions from this Grand Prix. For instance, I didn't realise this until this morning, that for the decade between 84 and 93, the race was won by only two drivers, absolutely in a field of their own during that time. Certainly in Monaco, Alan Prost and Ayrton Senna. And this was the era where we saw that extraordinary qualifying performance from Senna, particularly in 1988.
Yeah.
That was in the MP44, wasn't it? So the utterly dominant McLaren.
But he didn't win the race.
1.4 seconds faster than Prost. And he didn't win the race. Was that because he shunted?
Yeah, he was leading by a mile. He just binned it at the entrance to the tunnel. It was almost like for the first time, and almost certainly the last time in his career, he just let his mind wander. He lost his concentration, and under no pressure at all, totally unforced error, cruising to victory. But sometimes that's, cruising is not a very, it's, if you're driving as fast as you possibly can, you're not going to lose your concentration. And sometimes if you cruise, you do. And he did. And he was heartbroken by that. And he had a flat or something in Monaco, and he got out of the car and he basically just walked home, locked the door and wouldn't talk to anybody for quite a long time. It really, really affected him badly.
Yeah, you can imagine.
I mean, because of that, and also in some other words, I mean, McLaren's record, people talk about, Ayrton winning it six times and Michael and Graham Hill winning it five times. McLaren, how many wins at Monaco did McLaren have?
So plenty with Ayrton, Lewis, Coulthard, 10.
So the second most, I hate this word, wingiest.
Yeah.
Mark, is Ferrari, which has been in Formula One for an awful lot longer than McLaren, and it's done it. It's won it 10 times. Mm. Yeah? McLarens have won Monaco 15 times.
Crikey.
Half as many times again as Ferrari. And people never talk about that.
No, I didn't know that. That's a huge number.
Mm.
Not for a while, though. Was Lewis the last one in 2008? Must have been.
Yeah, must have been. Yeah.
It's been a while.
That's an interesting... Lewis is another interesting thing. Mm. And I say all this with under the headline of by Lewis standards. By Lewis standards, if not by anybody else's, he's rubbish at Monaco.
He's won it three times, which is the same as...
Sterling, same as Nico. Compared to other circuits that he would have been to. So where were he? He started in 7, didn't he? We're now at 22. So this is his 16th season in Formula One. So with other circuits, he would have raced at 16 times. you know, some of them he must have won. I don't know. Where's he won most at? I don't know.
Someone could tell us. I think it's Canada. I think he's won six or seven.
Okay, so that's twice as many as Monaco. Do you think that's just bad luck, or do you think that says something about his driving style? Or
I think it's partly because a little bit of bad luck, and I think there was one year where he was due the win. There was an issue, or his team Mercedes pitted him unnecessarily, and that handed it to Rosberg. So, you know, if you think about that swing, if he had won that one, that would be 4-2, and then we wouldn't be having this conversation probably.
Because, you know,
I also think that the Mercedes has tended to be a long wheelbase car, which is really punishing around Monaco.
Good point.
The Red Bull has often been the dominant car around there with lots and lots of downforce and a shorter wheelbase. So
it's a good point.
But I agree. He's not been dominant there like he has other places.
No. It's interesting, isn't it?
Where were we? You've mentioned
Monaco, I think.
We were in Monaco. You mentioned Graham Hill winning five times. He was Mr. Monaco. Of course, the record, though, is Ayrton Senna's with six. We have mentioned the 1982 race before, so we won't dwell on it. But I suppose I bring this up now because it's worth saying that some of the most incredible moments in F1 history have happened at Monaco.
Yes, I think 82 might go down as the funniest Formula One race, or one of the funniest Formula One races.
The one no one wanted to win.
That no one wanted to win. Yes.
And I mean, we can't go through it now because it's really complex. But basically, in the last couple of laps, several drivers span off or crashed out or ran out of fuel. And it appeared that no one actually wanted to get across the line first to win the bloody thing. So in the end, Riccardo Patrese, who spun on that lap or the lap before, eventually came through to win the race. So it was a totally chaotic, frenetic
end to
the Grand Prix.
So in that race, okay, so Reni Arnoux led a lot of it, and then Prost led the rest of it until two laps till the end. So that's Arnoux and Prost, who are at that time both pretty much, given whoever's leading tends to win, very much expected to win. So there was Arnoux and Prost, and then Patrese was definitely going to win it until he binned it. And then it was Pironi was definitely going to win it until he stopped in the tunnel. And then De Cesaris was going to win it until he ran out of fuel. And then Derek Daly was going to win it until his gearbox seized. And then Patrese came back having spun it and was going to win it and not going to win it, came back and then finally won.
Oh, you've done it. Well done.
It's bonkers. I had to write it down this morning because I didn't want to sort of splurge it out and get it wrong.
It's on YouTube. You can go and watch it. James Hunt commentating.
Yes.
1996, only three cars finished. So if you get to the end of that race, you're on the podium because it was a wet to dry one. Won by Olivier Panis, his only F1 win. And Coulthard and Johnny Herbert, second and third.
Okay, 1,000 intercooler points to you if you can tell me what was unique about the 1952 race.
There wasn't one?
There was one. Although interesting, there wasn't one in 51, 53, or 54. So it's not like the British Grand Prix.
It was an F2 race.
No, it wasn't an F2 race. Close. You're in the right direction, though.
Okay, go on. Let's have it.
It was a sports car race.
Oh.
It was a non-champion. Frankly, it's the only reason I ever got to race there. The only reason they race sports cars at Monaco in the historic is because for 1 year only, the Monaco Grand Prix was a non-championship sports car race. So I'm very grateful for that.
Mm. Okay, well, hold on to that thought because we must talk about it. The other flashpoint that I wanted to recall was Michael Schumacher parking up in qualifying in 2006. He was quickest. But Fernando Alonso in his Renault was behind him, going faster, looked likely to take pole. And so Schumacher parks up at Le Rascasse. And that's it. That's the end of qualifying. Didn't get away with it. He was sent to the back of the grid by the stewards. So it didn't exactly work out in his favour.
Didn't Nico do something similar to Lewis as well?
Yeah, he was a bit more dastardly. So we can't say for certain it was intentional because he went down the slip road knowing that if anyone goes, perhaps knowing that if anyone went down that slip road, there'd be a yellow flag. maybe.
But it just goes through, again, it just shows just how important quali is there, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does.
You know, if you see P1 come off on your dash, in, you know, and you're on your slowing down lap, and you know that your probably quicker teammate is on his hot one, and you just think, if I just nip down there, I'm on pole.
And I'll probably win the race.
Probably win the race. Might win the championship.
It? Yeah. Yeah. Very tempting. Okay, so, I mean, the point of all that was to demonstrate that we don't get good wheel-to-wheel racing necessarily at Monaco, but there have been lots of flashpoints. I guess because it's one people are so determined to win, and it's one where there is zero margin for error. But, I mean, you have a unique perspective here. You've not raced a Formula One car there, but you have raced an old sports car there. Just tell us a little bit about what it's like. I mean, are you constantly looking at the barriers and the walls thinking, I could hit that?
Okay. Well, I think the first thing I would say, it was never somewhere that I dreamt of racing. I wanted to race the great European circuits. I wanted to race at Le Mans, the Nürburgring and Spa. That's what I really wanted to do. Monaco was never there. But then, of course, the opportunity came up. And, of course, why wouldn't you? And, you know, so it was the 2014 Monaco Historics. I was in this beautiful, beautiful C-type Jaguar. And I was just really bloody nervous. I mean, the car wasn't insured, unbelievably. And I just didn't want to bin it. And I remember just driving around and thinking, well, it's very interesting, but I can't really see how you can string it together, let alone make it all flow. And I think we had some practice, and that was okay. And then in qualifying, I decided that I was going to throw qualifying because I wanted to be right at the back. So I was just going to let him go because if there was any kind of carnage, I just wanted to be as far from it as possible. And there are only two ways of doing that. One is to be on pole and disappear, and that was never going to happen. And the other is to be right at the back. But I don't know how. It's the only time I've ever stuffed it up by going faster than I wanted, than I intended to. But I ended up literally in the middle. I think I was like sort of P12 on the grid or something. And then in the race, something really strange happened. I just kind of, and you know, people who race there regularly say that this happens there. You just find the rhythm. And then suddenly this, what looks like this most Mickey Mouse of circuits, just starts to really, really flow. And particularly the bit from, so you come out the tunnel and you've got that horrible little chicane, which isn't nice. But from there through to back and through the whole swimming pool complex, it's absolutely epic. And everything looks different to any other track you race on. Everything sounds different because you've got all the noise bouncing off the walls. And what you mustn't do is find yourself in a position where you're sort of looking around and thinking, I'm racing at Monaco, because then you're in the wall. There's really very little time to think of anything, even on a very slow car like a C-type. You're always busy, particularly if there are people around you. I did overtake someone at Monaco.
Good work.
I've done that.
Good work.
I took somebody else in a C-type, and it was Alain Ducadnet, although he had drum brakes and I had discs, and it was towards the end of the race, and I suspect his brakes were getting tired. But nevertheless,
we now know that you can overtake at Monaco. Andrew Frankel has proven it.
I think he probably also gave me. He probably realised I was, more keen on, you know, getting ahead than he wasn't keeping me behind. So I think he probably just let me go anyway. But anyway, it's strange, and I actually ended up really loving it, absolutely loving it, in a way I'd never expected. And I'd gone there and Gary Pearson very kindly walked me around the entire circuit and showed me all the little bits of curb that you use and bits of curb that you don't use. And, you know, we are going up the hill towards Casino Square and they've got that, what is it, Massenet? That really quick left going down to Casino Square. And judging where to brake for that is an absolute nightmare. And it's, I can't remember, but it's like the sort of, it's either the second bus stop or the third pedestrian crossing or something that you brake out. Or turn in at. And, I'd learned all that. And suddenly, because of all this help that I'd had and I'd spent a bit of time on the circuit, it kind of got together and then it was wonderful. But, God, I wouldn't want to race anything wider than a C-type, let alone half a metre wider, let alone something, you know, with whatever they got, 900 horsepower. Probably at 250. I mean, it's just, I mean, hats off to that. I just don't know how they do it. The speed at which their brains must work. You know, and also, you know, there are 20 of them out there in these cars. I just don't know how they do it. It is absolute. And that in itself, just seeing them do that and just appreciating the enormity of the talent on display is something of a spectacle. But it's still not great racing, is it?
Well, you make two very good points there. So let's discuss that. Let's talk about whether or not it deserves its place on the F1 calendar and whether or not it deserves its special status as one of the three pillars of the Triple Crown of motorsport. Because even now, or perhaps more so now than ever before, when the cars are this fast and this big and powerful, qualifying at Monaco is an almighty spectacle. The fastest cars in the world, the best drivers in the world, absolutely flat out around this place where there is so little room, no margin for error. And Lewis said it in a video the other day, to be fast qualifying in Monaco, you have to be prepared to touch the walls. So it gives you an idea of the precision they need to be capable of.
I mean, to the extent that you can see them do this sometimes, they will nudge the barrier, but they will be so precise. It is just the very corner, just where the tyre just curves down. It's like a millimetric. Not enough to destabilise the car. And if they'd done, you know, like a centimetre more, they'd have taken the corner off the car and they'd been in the wall straight away. Yeah. And you think of the speed that they are doing it at. It's...
It
depends where you'll be listening to this. So, I mean, I hope that when you watch this on Saturday, which is actually ahead of where we're recording this, but that everybody just takes time to just focus on, because actually it's quali at Monaco. It's the only race of the year where quali is usually more interesting than the race.
And do you know what? There are lots of circuits that, for safety reasons, have enormous runoffs. Think of Paul Ricard, for instance. You don't get to appreciate the skill of a qualifying lap there, but at Monaco, you appreciate it. As a demonstration of skill, it's second to none.
There is nowhere to go.
Yeah. That's the Saturday. And then we have the Sunday. And as we've mentioned, unless something unforeseen happens, which it can do, the bloke who's on pole trundles round, keeps everyone behind and wins the race. Normally. Yeah. And the cars are too big. They're too wide. There's no space to overtake. And so it becomes processional. So that's the argument against, isn't it? Is that it actually quite rarely throws up a really compelling Grand Prix.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and that's a, you know, usually what has to happen to get an interesting Monaco. You know, usually what you need is some weather, don't you?
We might have some this weekend.
Oh, okay. So like a Panis 96, you know, can we just talk about 1984 for a moment? You know, when, you know, that is the race that Senna should have won in the Tolman. And it was ended, I think, on lap 32, when Alain Prost, driving McLaren, won the race. And Jackie Ickx, unilaterally, without going to the stewards, decided to end, and he was the clerk of the court, he decided to end the race. And the fact that... that Prost had a Porsche engine in the back of his McLaren and that Ickx was a works Porsche driver at the time, I'm sure had nothing whatever to do with it. But, you know, that was extraordinary because, you know, Senna got past Prost and the race ended that lap, and because you always take it from whoever's leading the lap before, that's the only reason that Alain Prost is on paper deemed to have won that race. And let's not forget at the same time, Stefan Bellof, who's always forgotten that race, he started 20th. Came third.
That is amazing.
In a normally aspirated car against the turbo cars. So you do get these anomalies. Sometimes it's so wet there and so slow. So in 1972, this is the last Formula One race that BRM ever won. Jean-Pierre Beltoise, in the only Formula One race he ever won, okay, he won there in 1972 in a 3-litre, well, not slickster, they'd have been on wets at the time, but nevertheless, big fat tyres, wings, 3 litres, 500 horsepower Formula One car in the second slowest Monaco Grand Prix in history. It's literally only the first one in 1950, when they basically had bicycle tyres, was slower. Every other one before and since. So that's how wet it was then. And that was just pure survival. So it can happen, but it's quite rare. And as I say, you need something unexpected. You need Sterling in that Lotus 18 holding off the Ferraris just through outrageous talent. But even then, You know, there wasn't a lot of overtaking done. That was just Sterling keeping people behind him. So, yeah, you do, you know, you need a bit of luck.
So even now, when we know that it is very often a disappointing Grand Prix, I feel a frisson of excitement coming into Monaco Grand Prix weekend. I feel it right now. And maybe it's because qualifying is so exciting. But, I mean, there does appear now to be a very real discussion around its future as a Formula One race. I don't know if this is Liberty Media bluffing to try and, you know, achieve something. Karun Chandhok wrote about the Monaco Grand Prix for us recently, and he explained that it doesn't generate a huge amount of revenue for Formula One, partly because there's a legacy commercial agreement that means the ACM gets to keep some of the, or a lot of the trackside ad revenue, relatively few ticket sales because there just isn't the space. And so this might be why Liberty is flexing a little bit to try and generate more revenue from the Grand Prix. Or maybe Liberty does want to get rid of it and replace it with one that will earn more money.
What do you think? Should it stay or should it go?
So you get
rubbish motor races there. It's been on the calendar for, well, certainly longer than any other race because, you know, it massively predates even the World Championship. And all these other reasons. So you're you know, Ross Brawn or whoever runs Formula One. Would you keep it or would you bin it?
Despite everything, despite the fact that we know it's often not that exciting, the race at least, I keep it. Because I think it adds texture to F1. And I don't care about the glamour, the yachts, the harbour. I don't care about that stuff. I care that it's a very distinctive street circuit. It's a challenge unlike any other. And I think racing categories become a bit dull and lifeless when you just have this cookie cutter thing where all the different events have the same feel to them. But I agree, there are problems with it.
I'd keep it. Because it's one race in a season of, well, 22 races this year because Russia's gone. So it's, you know, it's less than 5% of the season. It is a unique spectacle. But what I think I probably would do if I was Formula One, I would say that I would acknowledge the fact that Monaco is different to any other race. It just is. And I would use that opportunity to treat it differently. And I do strange stuff with it. I might suddenly throw a reverse grid at it or something. I'd do something, whatever I could, to spice up the spectacle. Because I think if you just run it to the same rules that every other race runs, then you're going to get what you get. So you need to find a way, and it cannot be beyond the wit of the organiser of Formula One to, given all the different things that they can do, all the ways that they can, you know, level up the playing field a little bit between the back and the front of the grid. So I would do whatever I could to make, they're not actually at the moment doing anything to make the racing more interesting. It's just treated the same as any other race. And there is stuff that they could do. So I would keep it. It's the Monaco Grand Prix, for goodness sake. You can't, well, I mean, I'm a diehard old traditionalist, but I think that Formula One would be poorer without it. Could it survive without it? Of course it could. But it would be poorer without it. And I would miss it. And also, you know, I'd also take the view that, yeah, okay, so Sunday may not be that much fun, but, you know, Saturday is amazing. You know, so you get your kicks on one day of the week rather than the other. I don't know, but there's, you know, things they can do with sprint formats. They could do, I don't know, successful. I mean, I certainly wouldn't look at, there's nothing I wouldn't look at as a way of just spicing it up. And I would just, you know, it has always had a unique position in the calendar. It has always been treated in a unique way by the organisers of Formula One. It is a unique event. So I would give it its own unique set of rules.
Good idea. Yeah, reform rather than booting it out altogether. Charles Leclerc came out this week in an interview and said, and he is Monegasque, isn't he? So he has a particular view. But he said F1 without Monaco for him isn't Monaco, reflecting the views of many. Others think it's a relic and a dinosaur. And there's a good case to be made there. I do wonder if there's something about the glamour of it all. So all of a sudden, in this day and age, feeling irrelevant to most people. I think about the Oscars. So this is a very glitzy award ceremony, which ultimately is millionaires giving nice shiny statues to millionaires. And us plebs are, what, supposed to be grateful that we get to witness this? And I just wonder if there's something about changing attitudes, a changing society. In its heyday, we, you know, Monaco, we think of Princess Grace, the casino, the yachts, the Riviera, all very appealing. But as the world has become more conscious about wealth inequality and of tax avoidance, and Monaco is a tax haven for the super rich, I do wonder if more and more people are looking at Monaco and seeing the nefarious side of it, not the glamour and the beauty of it.
And, well,
I wonder if that's bubbling away in, underneath.
I think, well, it's a very, very interesting point. And certainly things like the Oscars have nothing like the status or interest among the public that they used to have. And partly that's because we've all got so many other things to distract us and that sort of thing. But I think also, I think there's an awful lot in what you say. That said, you know, I think Formula One is a glamorous sport. It's certainly meant to be. And I have no particular problem with that. Yeah, I've got a massively bigger problem with them going to Bahrain and Saudi Arabia and, you know, and all the stuff that goes on there. And yeah, you know, Monaco is a tax haven, but you know, I don't know. It's I think it's better on the calendar than not, and I think that there are other places that Formula One goes which are far more questionable than Monaco, at least to me.
That's a good point. Okay, well, that's the Monaco Grand Prix. It's an interesting one, isn't it? And you'll know if we had a good race over the weekend, because we'll have come back to talk about it at the start of the podcast. If we didn't bother, clearly it was an unremarkable Grand Prix, which is part of the problem, isn't it? So, yeah, I just hope it's a good one, because I do look forward to it each year. We'll see. So thank you, JBR Capital, for sponsoring the podcast. If you're looking to buy a car, a new car or a used car, go and see what JBR Capital can do for you on the finance side. Please also rate and review the podcast, subscribe or follow wherever you get your podcasts. Before we move on to the listener question, I just want to mention the Toyota GR86, which I've been driving this week. Replacement to the GT86, which is a car you adore, isn't it?
Well,
you really like that
car. It amuses me. I didn't say I don't adore it. I've never been anything less than thoroughly entertained by them, though. But I read what you've written, and you weren't such a big fan of it, were you?
So I had fun in a GT86 on track one time, and I thought it was brilliant there. But I didn't like the gear shift, I didn't like the clutch pedal action, I didn't like the steering, I didn't like the engine. So I had there were lots of things that about it. I didn't like the tyres, lots of things about it that annoyed me on the road. This new car, the GR86, which is actually an evolution of it, totally addresses every concern and criticism that I had of the GT86. It's fantastic, and it's no less fun to drive.
Yep. There is one.
The engine is sweeter.
Massive problem with it. Massive problem.
Unless you got one of the first allocation of 430 cars, I think it is. You ain't going to get one. They're trying. Toyota GB are trying to get a few more cars in. But they have to get them from other markets. Subaru can't just build more, because the thing's only going to be in production for 2 years, but owing to safety legislation that changes in 2024. So there is very limited supply. And if Toyota GB manages to get more, it'll be from other markets. So, you know, it's not as though they're going to suddenly find a couple of thousand cars and meet demand.
No.
They might find maybe the same again, although I'd be surprised.
So would I.
So it's, and there are no guarantees they'll find it even a single car extra. So it will be a rare car in the UK. If you've got one, congratulations.
Yeah.
If you haven't,
I imagine the residuals will be quite good on one of those.
There's going to be an overs market for it, isn't
there? Maybe.
Particularly because it's so good to drive. I mean, my full review is on the Intercooler app now. Go and check it out. And as has become tradition, we end these podcasts with a listener question. This one is from Keith Gibson. Thank you for your question, Keith. If you could have any writer from any period contributing to TI, who would they be? he suggested Setrite and Russell Bulgin, but we want your answers, Andrew.
Okay. obviously not including the ones who already do, because actually, and I'm not just saying this to keep our contributor sweet, so many of the people who would be on that list are already writing for us, for which I feel insanely lucky. And, you know, it's a very perceptive question, particularly the names already given, because I think the Setright and Bulgin are probably the two names that most immediately spring to mind. But also, but you know, so, you know, Chris Harris, I'd love him to do some stuff for us. He is quite busy at the moment, being a television star and so on and so forth. You know, Steve Cropley, again, would love him to, but, you know, he is contracted to Autocar, which is, you know, completely understandable. And then looking back, I just love that sort of 70s, 80s era of car magazines. So guys like Steady Barker, George Bishop, Phil Llewellyn, wonderful, wonderful writers. Doug Blaine, you know, the bloke who basically started Car Magazine. Yeah, there are so many, aren't there? But at the same time, I just think that the guys and girls that we have writing for us now are superb and as good as you'll find anywhere in the world, frankly, in motoring journalism as a team. And so, you know, what I'm not doing is sitting here thinking, oh, if only we could have had this, that and the other, because I think the team we got is absolutely fabulous.
I'd love to have May and Clarkson, because they've both meant so much to me as a car enthusiast and as a car journalist as well. Also, I mean, there are certain difficulties here, but what about Hunter S. Thompson and PJ O'Rourke?
Well, yeah.
People like that.
But they're not motoring journalists, are they, as such? No. But yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Those iconoclasts who just write so brilliantly, so vividly, and with such attitude.
Yeah.
I think they would have been a wonderful fit for TI. So there we go. Thank you for your question. It's a good one. Get your listener questions in, because we like ending the podcast that way. And we'll do that again next week.
Thank you very much.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.